thank you guys so much for making time to come on the show today. I am really excited to hear all about your Colorado Trail records. It was definitely a busy summer out there. So Kyle, there may be some listeners who aren't super familiar with what the Colorado Trail is. So I was wondering if you could give a brief overview to start us off, like what the Colorado Trail is, where it starts and ends, how long it is, all of that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's a 500-ish, almost 500-mile path from Durango to Denver. And it essentially is just like a grand tour of Colorado. It follows the mountain ranges that connect the two cities. And a lot of that parallels with the Continental Divide Trail. But it's a trail that first was developed about 50 years ago. Actually, this year is the 50th anniversary of it. And it's been in development and a lot of changes going on, but it's the grand tour of all of the cool spots in Colorado.
That's awesome. I didn't actually realize it was the 50th anniversary this year, so that's pretty cool. The trail's all over the place. There's west to east, east to west, collegiate east, collegiate west. There's all these options. So I'd like it if you could say your name and which variation you went and why you chose that particular variation of direction.
So I'm DJ Fox. I went west to east and I went the collegiate east route. So I chose that route. This was the second time I attempted the CT in 2 years. I went last year and I was chasing Mike McKnight's record, which happened to be the fastest at the time. And it was Durango to Denver, collegiate east. So running it again this year, I have a bit of the logistics down. We've seen a lot of it before. I've got some returning crew members. So it seemed like the best idea to run it again, chase what we knew a little bit, and get a better shot at it.
Stick with what you know. Jeff, how about you?
I'm Jeff Browning. I did west to east, or Durango to Denver, collegiate west. The reason I chose that, one, I love the San Juans. I wanted to be fresh in the San Juans and really enjoy them because they're just some of the prettiest section of the Colorado Trail, in my opinion. And they're just pretty special to me because I live in Flagstaff. I'm pretty close to Durango. I've run Hard Rock 7 times. So I've been in that area a ton. I've trained a lot over the last decade there. So I wanted to be fresh for that section. I chose Collegiate West because it's the higher alpine, harder kind of Continental Divide Trail section south of Leadville. And it's really pretty. I've been on the Collegiate East, some of it. And it's just down in the trees. It's not that pretty. There's not many views. So for me, I wanted to do the harder Collegiate West because that spoke to me. I grew up in the Midwest. So after college, I moved to Denver in the late 90s. And so I spent a lot of time on that kind of Waterton Canyon. I was a mountain biker back then and backpacker. And I did a lot of some backpacking trips on the Colorado Trail in that first like 100 miles coming out of Denver. So there was a slight familiarity with that part of the trail. And I thought it'd be kind of cool to finish there since I used to live there.
Nice. And Brent, how about you?
I'm Brent Herring. I live in Durango, just like DJ does. And so I chose east to west, collegiate west, basically because I just wanted to arrive at home and not worry about the logistics of getting back from Denver. And I'd heard that the west side of the collegiates was a lot more mountainous and pretty, and I don't know. That appealed to me.
Kyle?
I went from Denver to Durango, and in part because I live in Durango and just the mental aspect of running home is really important and was really beneficial during the run. And then there are two options in the middle. You can go the original route, Collegiate East, or I guess 18 years after the Colorado Trail was developed, the Continental Divide Trail used a lot of that research in the same paths going through Colorado. And so the Collegiate West path developed, and that's like a higher route. It stays on the Continental Divide and it's not bike friendly. So that's the later route. And I think the more interesting route and the more challenging route. And that's the route that excited me. And so I took Denver to Durango and then Collegiate West.
That just blows me away that you did the harder route and you have the fastest Colorado Trail time of all variations. And you also brought the record under 7 days for the first time. So this is really huge. And I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about setting that goal, going after that goal, how it feels to achieve it. Because this is like a big thing.
Sure. And as far as setting that goal, a lot of our conversation up to this point is kind of why I had to just simplify it both for myself and to explain everything else, to just say there are so many variations when you add in Collegiate East, Collegiate West, Durango to Denver or vice versa, and then supported, unsupported, and self-supported. There's just so many variations. So just as a motivation thing and then trying to have this conversation 1,000 times, I just said, I want to do the fastest time ever, which nobody's ever done in under a week too. So that was just setting out the goal of, it doesn't matter what variation, I want to do the fastest and I want to do it under a week, which nobody's ever done before. And those are like incremental steps too. Over time, the time has gone down and down and down, and just this is the next jump forward of trying to get it to that.
Was there a moment on there where you didn't think you were going to make it, or a moment when you suddenly realized you were going to make it?
The climax, as far as that goes, of highs and lows, was definitely on the Collegiate West. So I started Collegiate West, which begins at the Twin Peaks area. And I started that at the third morning. So I'd gone through a whole day, a whole night, a second day and a second night. And going into that third day, I was at mile 170-ish at Twin Peaks. And that's where the split off is. And actually, when I did it in early June, there was a fire there. So there's a reroute. And so it's like this extra level of difficulty in there, or challenge, I guess, anyway, to decide to go east or west. And I wasn't 100% sure which way I would go starting out. So it was kind of like a last minute decision to do that east or west. And once I started west, that was the low point of the whole trail for me. It was just getting to be very difficult. I think I was really suffering at altitude, and my pace was really starting to slow down at that point. And I was worried that I messed up my chance of breaking any record at all by trying this Collegiate West route, versus if I would have just gone the Collegiate East, maybe I could have ran a faster time and got it. But then on the reverse end of that, once I did make it through the Collegiate East, that was the only part of the trail that was new to me. I'd hiked the trail 7 years before, so I'd seen everything on the Collegiate East. And once I got through to Collegiate West, and it rejoins at the Foose Ridge just south of Monarch. Once I got to there, my crew kind of reassured me of like the pace and the times and what I'd done so far. And like, no, you're doing great. You're on pace. You're over halfway through. And then it was kind of like, okay, as long as I don't mess up, then I'm going to get a record.
Yeah, I can imagine there's that moment of, oh, why did I pick to go the harder way?
Yeah, snow and down trees. It's a much more rugged, remote area on the Collegiate West side. They definitely don't even have like the same trail support network of like cutting down trees and whatnot. Especially on Collegiate East, there's all kinds of races that go on there between, you know, High Lonesome and Leadville. So there's like these other networks that also want to clear the trees, not just the local trail building network. So there's more support on that side. And on the west side, luckily you're above tree line, so the bigger issue was snow.
So DJ, I'd like to go back to what you were just mentioning, how you had done this and you attempted this last year, and you now have the second overall fastest time after Kyle. So what did it feel like, or what does it feel like to have achieved this now, especially after a failed attempt last year?
Yeah, it feels pretty good. That's been a project I've been working on for about a year and a half now, right? And that's exactly how I view it, as like a project. It's the only thing I put a focus on since I tried last year. I think I raced two other times this year, and they were just to get out and get some longer efforts in. But this is the only thing I had my eyes set on for the entire time. So to pass the location on the route where I pulled the plug last time was just like, I had a big emotional breakdown. It was a lot. And I was like, oh my God, I remember right here. I laid down and I called it and then hobbled my way over to a back road before we got a hold of an ambulance, and I got packed in the back there. It was special, you know, and then to finally get to that sign and realize that it was over, and not just the week I'd spent out there, but like I said, the year and a half buildup is all coming to a close, and it felt really good. I put a lot of effort into this. I put a lot of time into this. And yeah, I'm happy right now.
Yeah, that's a long period of time to be focused singularly on one goal.
Totally. And that's how I've always done it, right? For the few athletic achievements I've been able to pull off and pull out of thin air here, it's because I just put my head down on the one thing. Like once a year, I pick one event and I go all in on it, which is a scary way to approach these things, having all your eggs in one basket. It's like do or die at the end of the day. But when you do, you really do, and it feels good.
Yeah. And you mentioned having that emotional experience when you passed where you called it on last year's attempt. What point was that? How far into this was that?
It was about 420 miles in.
No, dude.
That's almost done.
It was so close. It hurt so bad. And it was the first time I ever had to pull out of anything. I realized after the fact that I didn't know how to stop. I felt it coming for quite a long time. And I'd get to the aid stations and the crew would be like, hey, how you doing? I'm like, great, you know, but I can't breathe. I'm wheezing. I'm having all sorts of problems. That was the thing that pulled me off course, was breathing issues. I ended up going to the hospital and I was diagnosed with pneumonia.
Oh, gosh.
I was just sick out on trail. They said it wasn't taped, right? I'm sure it was like a little bit of everything going on there, but I was just filling up with fluid. And every time I tried to get moving, it would just start gurgling a little bit. And I was like, all right, I'm finally at the end of my week here. And yeah, but a long ways in, very, very long ways in.
Wow. I mean, breathing is really important. So that makes sense. But wow. Jeff, what drew you to attempt the Colorado Trail FKT to take on something this big?
So many of my friends had the records over the years. Like, I know everyone on the list almost. So for me, it was always one of those bucket list items where you're like, yeah, I'd love to do that, but I just can't swing a week off. And so with the planning on the front end and travel and planning on the back end and recovering and then the whole attempt itself, you're talking like 2 weeks, right? So I never could swing it. Finally, my coaching business has grown to a point where I have assistant coaches now. I have 3 other coaches. I had people back cover for me while I'm gone. And so I'm an ultra running coach. So like, ultra runners understand that kind of stuff and they're stoked that you're doing something crazy like that. So I got to a point in my life where my lifestyle allowed for that kind of attempt. It's been probably 5 years where I've been serious about thinking about it and finally was like, okay, I'm going to go. I coach Mike McKnight. So I was coaching him when he got the record. So that really put it on my radar. And like, yeah, if you're going to do this, you need to do it soon, right? Because you're not getting any younger. 53 years old, you know? So it was finally where lifestyle meshed with being able to be gone for 2 weeks. And so then we really started planning it the last year or so. I kept it pretty quiet for a long time. I also wanted to get Moab and Cocodona under my belt just to have that long distance racing under my belt and the logistics of strategically sleeping and being on the move and crewing it. And so we used those as shorter test modules of how we would carry it over into something like the 490 mile Colorado Trails.
That's a super detailed process, but it obviously showed in how well it went for you.
Yeah, not that well. I mean, well enough to get the record, but I have to say I had 3 rough, rough days where I only hiked downhill because of some GI gut stuff. In hindsight, was actually a sickness and didn't know it at the time. My family got sick while I was gone and I got the same symptoms on the same day. And then I made some stupid decisions that really messed up my 3 days where I took Imodium. I would never do that again. Word to the wise, don't take Imodium. We have other natural solutions that will not clog you up for 3 days. So that was a really rough learning experience. And that's when I lost Kyle's overall. Like I was going for Kyle's overall and I was on it. And then 3 days of hiking downhill, I was off of it. And then I came back. I got it like squared away after 3 days. And the last few days went fast. But I definitely paid the piper for 3 days. And that, for me, knowing I'm not going to do it again is a little bittersweet, a little frustrating, just because I like to show up to things like super ready and dialed and like nail it the first time. And so sometimes there's things out of your hands or you make stupid decisions at a crossroads and that decision comes back to bite you. So in this case, it bit me for 3 days.
That's a long bite.
Yeah, it was a really long bite. It was really frustrating. I was not a happy camper when I was hiking downhill.
I bet. Brent, this was your first multi-day FKT, and I think your first thru-hike, if I read your report right. And you also chose to do this self-supported. So can you tell me about the process of leading you into attempting this and why you chose to do self-supported?
So I used to live in Breckenridge, and I'd be on the Colorado Trail where it overlapped the Continental Divide Trail a lot. And it was one of those things that was always abstract. I was curious about what it'd be like to connect it from Denver to Durango, but it seemed like a lot of time off. I'm married with 2 children. So it's like Jeff said, taking 10 days off is extremely difficult. And so it was one of those abstract things. I did a few FKTs that were always less than a day and thought it might be interesting. I went for the 14er record a few years back and it blew up in my face because the monsoon came in kind of like it did this year at all hours of the night. In all hours of the morning. But that's a lot different when you're trying to climb 14ers with wet rock versus just being on a trail. But anyway, after that, it really beat me down and I was demoralized and wanted redemption a little bit for that. And I was finishing the 14ers with Jason Hardrath over in the Elks, the last 7 of them. And I met some other people who had done a few through hike records. I think it was Josh Perry and she goes by Early Bird. Nika Myers. So I talked to them and it went from being abstract to being like, oh, this sounds like a real challenge. But even after that, I had no idea what to expect. This was much harder than I expected in so many ways. I think the second day for me was the most difficult because I went out too hard. It just took, I think, more tenacity and stubbornness than it did fitness for me personally.
Right. You mentioned the monsoon. So that brings me to the next topic I wanted to ask you guys about. So Brent, I was reading your trip report and it basically was just like, I'm out of battery and it's raining every day. So can you talk about the weather issues you had out there?
So I actually talked to Kyle beforehand and he highly recommended I take no stove. And he also said, don't bother bringing a tarp tent. And I was like, well, it's going to be monsoon season. He's like, yeah, but you're trying to go fast. You don't need those. I ignored his advice and brought both of those things initially. And the first night there was no rain, I thought it would rain. And then the second night, it also did not rain. So I was feeling kind of confident and cocky that I didn't actually need that tarp tent.
Definitely lulled you into a sense of complacency very quickly.
Yep. So I got to a cache and was like, oh, I don't need this. Left the tarp tent there. And then it just started cranking on me. It started out just lightly pouring one night.
Did you say lightly pouring?
Lightly pouring. It only lasted like 20 minutes. So I just took my ground sheet and made a burrito. And I was like, oh, I can do this the rest of the way. No big deal. But then it started raining at 9 p.m. It would rain at midnight. It would rain at 5 a.m. It's really hard to deal with that over time. We also got to a point where I was just resistant to it and was like, I'm sleeping under this pine tree. I might get soaking wet. I can still deal with that and get up and just start hiking when it's raining.
Did you have rain gear, like a rain jacket? Were you okay?
Yeah. Yeah, I had a rain jacket. I had rain pants that I never wore.
So you weren't like just getting completely soaking?
Yeah, I didn't have a bivy or anything. I just had my sleeping bag, a ground sheet, and then a pad to sleep on.
Wow. What about you, DJ? Did you have any weather challenges?
Oh, yeah. I had some nice weather out there. We started out and it was okay. It was like a little overcast coming out of Durango. We got up to Kennebec and started on Indian Ridge. And we got our first like light rain while we were out there. Nothing too bad. But if you turned around, like you could see it. It's starting to like build up pretty good and and follow us. But we got just past like the real nasty stuff there. Came off the ridge and it sprinkled for, I don't know, on and off for like the rest of the day. And as soon as night rolled around, we started to get hit with really heavy rain while we were out there, going like up and over Bolin Pass for that like 10-mile section-ish from Hotel Draw to Bola. We had like 5 feet of visibility the whole time, just like sitting in fog and clouds trying to navigate that with some pretty intense wind as well. And that was just on and off just like that. Basically for the rest of the night, got over into to Molis and it seemed to have settled down a little bit, you know. It was like 4 o'clock in the morning when I got there and I kind of just trudged right through. And yeah, then we went up and we got onto the Continental Divide Trail the next day. And basically as soon as we got up high, the weather started to get real nasty. Where we were in some like 45-mile-per-hour gusts. It was pelting rain and sleet. We got snowed on going up and over the high point. And the section between Stony and on our way into Carson, we were in some nice like light lightning storms, which was pretty exciting. Oh, not at all. Like that whole section is well above 12. We're like, me and my pacer are two lightning rods out there, and you know, it was storming on both sides and it was like a little clear in front of us and then a really heavy storm right behind us, like just following us the entire time. So I'm like looking at him, I'm like, how do you feel about this? And he's like, not great, you know. I'm like, well, it's a little early, but I feel like maybe we should get moving and get the heck off of this thing. And you know, kind of hustled a little faster than I really would have liked to. And then, and honestly, in the midst of all this, I was having some GI issues early on there, which was unfortunate, where I just felt like I had like a brick in my gut, dude. And it was like I was having a really hard time eating, and that combined with just like the nasty weather, I just made really poor eating decisions as well. Like again, my gut kind of hurt, but I probably still could have put more calories in me. And I think over the course of that whole day, I ended up, man, I mean, I probably had like 3,000 calories, which is like not even half of what I really would have wanted on the second day out there. But yeah, just like making a couple of errors and running away from weather and having a little bit of a gut discomfort kind of led to all that. But yeah, got to Carson and then, you know, we hopped in the Pacers truck and it started to storm pretty good, like hail and lightning. And then you could just see off in the distance, like one of like the gnarliest storm clouds I had ever experienced start to build up, just whole little sky turned black. And it was just like one little section. And I kind of like look at my Pacer again. I'm like, how do you feel about that? And he's like, oh dude, we're not going through that. And I'm like, okay, fair. You know, I just like close my eyes, kick my feet up in the back of the truck. And the whole time I just was kind of relaxing the best I can. And you could hear the storm going off and you just hear like the crew and Pacers like, oh, every time they're okay, I think we're good to go. It was about a half an hour for that little bit to blow through. And they were like, dude, that was the craziest lightning storm I've ever seen in my life. And it literally just like floated right over the high point on the trail right where we were heading. So I'm like, all right, good call. You know, like that's why you guys are out here. Cause I was like, you let's just go, you know, like, just, you know, deep into this thing already and like a little fatigue, like, no, it's not that bad. We should just go. And then got up high and that's, yeah, it started to snow on us and you could see more storms kind of developing on the sides. But yeah, I mean, we dealt with that the whole second day. Got my first sleep at Spring Creek Pass, like my first like real sleep. I'd taken a trail nap before that, probably about 24 hours in, where I just laid it down for like 15 or 20 minutes, but got to Spring Creek. I think I laid down for about 3 hours and then started the next morning a little bit before the sun came up. It looked like it was going to be a nice day. And then as soon as we got up high again, it wasn't storming, but it was just like a really thick overcast and heavy fog that we dealt with for basically that whole section going from Spring Creek into Eddiesville. And it was as soon as we got over San Luis Pass, the clouds finally broke up really for like the first time that we were out there. The sun blasted through. And I was able to take off like that whole time. I had, you know, I had a thermal wool layer on. I had a puffy jacket on. I had a raincoat and I had a rain pants and a beanie. And it felt so good to just finally shed those layers and let my flesh breathe a little bit. And then honestly, after that, I had pretty great weather the whole way. Little sprinkles here and there, but lots of sunshine and much more manageable after the first 48 hours.
How about you, Jeff?
It sprinkled a little bit the first day, but not bad. And I slept a little bit at Little Molas Lake Trailhead. And then that's where Kyle paced me from Little Molas over to Stony Pass. That was all good. I picked up Jesse Haynes and it was a nice day. So this would have been day two. We were climbing. We had just gone over Carson Saddle and it just sucked in the afternoon and started lightning all over Carson Saddle, that ridge that you run and you stay high for 7 or 8 miles. And we were just in it, like lightning and cracking around us. And we were just like, well, screw it. We're just going to run. We just kept moving and we didn't want to hunker down. We just decided that it was sporadic enough. It wasn't so concentrated. It wasn't that bad. But that was a really kind of a sucky day because after it blew through in the evening, because we got in before dusk into Spring Creek and I was going to sleep there. And because I was ahead of schedule at that point, but it was so muddy and slippery through there on the dirt roads. It was super saturated from that storm. So that kind of sucked, but I was going to sleep anyway. So I slept. And then kind of dried out. We got started, I think, maybe 11 o'clock at night, got going. And then I had pretty good weather until Tin Cup. And from Tin Cup, we had a gnarly night. That was like the peak of my gut issues. It was like really gnarly night. That 16-mile section took me 9 hours. I hiked the entire freaking section. I was at my lowest. I was just really depressed. I was ready to drop. I got in there and told everyone I was probably going to drop. The whole crew was like, we're going to put you down for sleeping. We'll make a decision in the morning. You know, good crew. And they were just like, we aren't going to make any rash decisions right now. Let's just let you sleep 3.5-4 hours. Because at that point, I had lost Kyle's record. And that was depressing too. I was retaining all this water. And finally, after sleeping in that section, my feet up, I dropped some of the water weight while sleeping. I got up in the morning and I told everybody, let's keep going. And everybody's super stoked. I think after Twin Lakes, I never had anything like super crazy after that. That was the worst night. It was foggy. We were in a cloud at night. It's a lot of really high above tree line section and rocky and scree and it was wet. It was raining on and off on us. So I had all my layers on plus micro down, waterproof pants. I even had wind pants under my waterproof pants. It was cold. It was super windy. So visibility was really crappy. So it's just overall, like, that was definitely the low spot of the whole 7 days. I just was like, what am I doing? So from there, the weather never got, there was a couple like really cold mornings and windy in Summit County where I was going up something early in the morning before dawn and we were just like exposed in the wind where it was kind of gnarly, but we never got hammered again. We got some sprinkles and a little bit of short storms where you put your jacket on for, you know, 15 minutes and you're like, oh, shed it off again. So it wasn't that big a deal. Typical Colorado weather.
So everybody else set their records later in the summer or early fall, but you were out there in June. So there would have been snow. Like you mentioned, there was a fire detour. Can you just talk about the weather, Kyle?
So despite there being a fire just before I started, one of the goals of starting so early was to reduce that fire risk. I really didn't want to be in a scenario where I started 3, 4, 5 days in and then a fire pops up and ruins my chance of finishing the record. The other big factor was daylight. So the closer you can go to the solstice right at the end of June, the longer your days are going to be. And the more daylight you have, the less you have to run at night. And then the third big factor for me was water. You're filtering water for a good portion of what you're going to be running. And the earlier you go in the year, the more snow runoff you have and the more creeks are running. So the less you have to carry as a whole team, both me individually and my pacers carrying water, we could just have more options and just makes that aspect a little bit easier. The downsides are obviously that all the downed trees along the way. And looking back, I talked with a lot of trail crew networks after I was done. And the evidence while I was out there was there too, that so much work was done in the week that I did the trail. There was like sawdust on the trail from where people had cut the trees just that week, just on specifically Elk Creek coming up to Mullis Pass in the last 100 miles of the trail. There were something in the ballpark like 170 trees down that week, and somebody had come in and cleared them all. I mean, that could be an hour difference in the record, just having trail crews in the area clear that out that week.
Yeah, totally. And what about the weather itself?
I don't think you can do the Colorado Trail without hitting some cool weather. That's just part of the experience. So actually, I had great weather in the beginning. Leaving Denver, there was a heat wave coming through. But there was also some clouds on the day I started, and they seemed to just follow me around. So the heat wasn't too bad in the lower elevations. Then we had a couple of days of really great weather going through Breckenridge into Tennessee Pass and Leadville. But on the back half of the trail, I really got a ton of rain and snow and hail. At one point, I was wearing a puffy rain jacket and ski pants going along Sergeant's Mesa. It was just full-on weather. But we were prepared for it and definitely knew that was an option, or a possibility anyway. So the river that runs through where I live in Durango is called the Animas. And normally the peak flow of that is from snow runoff sometime in May. And actually the peak runoff, so measured throughout the year, was the weekend I finished because there was so much rain and hail and precipitation in the last couple of days that the river hit a new high for the year.
Wow. Yeah. So I feel like you were out there before monsoon season started.
That was the goal also. Yeah, just so you don't have those like kind of more dangerous afternoon storms. Mm-hmm. I know you have like weather coming in like I did, but I don't think it's quite as electrical and quite as dangerous as far as that goes.
So you just had more like the precipitation sounds very wet. So let's talk about fueling, like what you ate. I think you've all at some point mentioned some GI issues. So let's hear all about this. DJ, how about you?
Last year, I basically drank small concentrated bottles of these liquid calories, and it served me really well until it like turned my mouth to like Swiss cheese, just having like salt water. And that was on like the third or fourth day last year. I'm like, man, every time I drink, I get really thirsty. And then all of a sudden, I had ulcers on my lips and in my mouth and everything. And we pulled out the liquid calories, the salty and sweet drinks, and I started to recover a little bit. Like, it was kind of laborious eating after that because my mouth was a wreck. So like, chewing anything was labored. So I took that last year and brought it to this year, and I was doing these high concentration mixes, which I practiced with a ton. But I mean, you can only understand what it's going to do to you after doing it for a whole day, right? So yeah, this time I had 900 calories in these 500 milliliter soft flasks, and I was drinking that every 20 to 30 minutes and rinsing my mouth out with water, and my mouth hygiene stayed a lot better, but it ended up doing a number on my gut. The thought of it started to get to me, and I'm like, man, that's the thing. That's just building in my stomach, and making me extremely uncomfortable. So I talked to a few people after, one of them being Kyle, and he was like, yeah, I think the move is like going back and forth between these high and low concentrations and finding a little bit of reprieve. It was just too much of this syrup that hit me at the end of the day. So I basically was eating 100 calories every hour. Like, I'd be like, hey, Rick, what do you want? And I'm like, nothing, but give me a chewy bar, you know, I'll put something in. And the solids ended up being my saving grace at the end of the day. I never went back to the liquid calories. I was able to put gels down and just eat food.
That's interesting, DJ, because I experienced the exact same thing. I started with Tailwind and some extra sodium concentration in one bottle and water in the other and rinsing. And I had the same thing. I started to get to the point where I couldn't take it down anymore. And I had to ditch it. And I went to just water, electrolyte capsules, and then gels and chews and solid food the last like 4 days. My wife made potato pancakes. She took the instant mashed potatoes and she put eggs and salt with it and made little patties, made like 30 of them, put them in 2 different gallon Ziplocs, like 15 in each one. She put parchment paper between each one so they wouldn't stick together, and she had them all frozen. And then we put them in a cooler, and then we would let one thaw out at a time once they're thawed out. We had a trucker's warming plate, and you just plug it in and it runs up to 120 degrees. And they would just do it while driving, and then it'd get there and you just leave it in there and it stays warm. They put melted cheese over it, and then they would pack that in aluminum foil with my pacer with cold bacon. And we'd put a piece of bacon and fold it backwards so the cheese was on the outside because it would hold the crumbly potato pancake intact. And you'd eat like a little taco, like a trail taco with bacon in the middle. So you'd be doing gels every top of the hour, chews at the bottom of the hour for a couple hours. We'd get to 3 hours and it'd be like, I'd be looking at my watch. Is it 3 hours? Yeah, it's 3 hours, time for a freaking bacon pancake.
Jeff, I watched a video where you were going on and on about potassium citrate. What does that do? And did it help?
Well, so potassium, so if you're taking sodium, right, you have to have a ratio of potassium to be able to absorb sodium. And there's a ratio balance in the system that the body likes, a homeostasis between potassium and sodium. So you can't just take sodium, right? And you can't just take potassium. So with all these GI issues, I had some water retention. I was thinking, well, maybe I just need more potassium, right? This is where one of my biggest mistakes was not having my wife on the crew. She typically crews in 200s. That was probably my biggest logistical mistake. Because one, we've been married for 27 years and we've been together for 31 years. And she knows me better than anyone. We're also very aligned on nutrition and supplements and everything. And she's kind of a guru when it comes to supplements and natural remedies. But, you know, hindsight's 20/20. It came back through my crew chief, Ryan, was talking to my wife. They're good friends. So they were back and forth. They've crewed together before. So they were like chatting on the phone constantly. He came to me at one point. He's like, dude, your family has a GI bug right now. I was trying to do nutritional changes thinking that's what it was, when it really was. And then I made that decision to take the Imodium, which for me ruined me. That's what caused the most problems. It caused water retention. It caused to clog me up for 3 days straight. And it took 3 tablespoons of magnesium to break the dam after 3 days. I never had problems putting food down. I had really good food, good cook, you know, so I never had that kind of problem. I just had this GI issue where I backed up and my gut was so distended, I gained like tons of weight. And it was to the point where my gut looked otherworldly.
Brent, how did your fueling and all of that go while you were out there?
After hearing their stories, it's going to sound really anticlimactic. I didn't have any GI issues. I had real food at Copper and Monarch because I was self-supported. So those are my two only opportunities to have a hot meal. And that set me over the moon. I was mostly eating real food and really generic stuff like Gatorade. Every single cache had a Coca-Cola in it that I would house immediately. Shotgun it as if it was a beer and I was in college. And I had lots of gummies, trail mix. So it was a lot of diverse food, but it was all stuff that I didn't have to worry about cooking. And the only thing I had, I did have a stove initially and realized I really didn't need that. So I started cold soaking Farm to Summit meals. And I'd have at least one of those a day just to feel like I was eating real food, even though it wasn't, because the trail mix was starting to wear on me. So my biggest problem actually was running out of food at one point. I had about 1,000 to 1,500 calories left. And I had like 30 to 40 miles until my next cache and realized that was not going to be sustainable. So I think I was climbing over Hope Pass and messaged a friend. I was like, I might have to pull out. I have no food left. And he's like, you should see plenty of people there. Just start mooching stuff. And so one guy gave me a gel and then another one gave me two gels. I was like, oh, this is going to be really rough. I can't just go on gels. And then I met two women coming from Cottonwood Pass on their way to Twin Lakes for a wedding. And they had about 7 pounds worth of food they didn't want to carry anymore. And they're like, here's all of our trail mix, a bunch of protein bars. Here's everything we got. It's yours. So yeah, it was very different than the experience of the other two guys who were supported.
Yeah. There's definitely huge variation between supported and self-supported and reaching the location where you can get more food. And it sounds like you had caches too. So those are discrete points and the calories are not unlimited.
Yeah, I was trying to do about 10,000 a day and realized I couldn't do that. It was just too much to eat while walking and running. I think I ended up averaging about 7,500 and that was enough for me. And just like DJ, I could tell every time I was in a hole because there was one day where I only got about 4,000 in just because I was low. And it set me back the next day too. It was one of those days where I slept like 5 hours, woke up and had no energy, felt like I hadn't slept whatsoever. And I soon realized it was a result of not having enough calories.
Yeah. Kyle?
I just expanded my 100-mile nutrition for a week. I was hoping to eat more real food. We had a fridge and a air fryer set up in our crew van. Throughout the whole time, none of that stuff really seemed that appealing. So the backbone of my nutrition for the entire time was Tailwind and gels.
Wow.
I was doing somewhere in the ballpark, like 300 calories an hour, pretty much the whole time. I would eat bits of real food, but it never felt great.
Did you ever get like the thing in your, like with your mouth? Like I've had that when I do too many gels and Tailwind where your mouth just kind of gets all like painful and burny. Like did that happen to you? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do know what you're talking about. I've had that in races before. And kind of my solution to that was I would just take my sip of or drink or eat whatever it was and just make sure I rinsed out with water and brushed my teeth. And that really goes a pretty far way to like keeping that mouth soreness down.
I'd like to wrap up with your favorite moment or favorite story, something memorable from your FKTs. DJ, you want to start us off?
So the second time I actually laid down and got some legitimate rest was at the top of Sergeant's Mesa. And that whole day was very hard. This is the third day after not eating enough. And I was having ankle issues from like Stony Pass on. So I was starting to get in my head a little bit after all these things. And that trudge up Sergeant's is like technical. It was dark. I like kicked every rock I planned on stepping over. I was stumbling around. I'm like, oh my God, I just need to get to the truck so I can sleep. I got there. They were like, you want food? I'm like, no, I want to go to bed. And they're like, all right, you have to eat. So I put some in me. I laid it down, passed out for 2 hours and woke up. It's like distraught in the morning. I was like, man, what did I get myself into again? I've got a long ways to go. I'm having a hard time eating a little bit in the morning, changing my shoes. And as I'm getting ready, a couple of bikers come through, a couple of through hikers. And there's this one guy. He's like, oh, hey, what's going on? And like sees me like a total mess, trying to get myself together, and he starts talking to the rest of the crew and asking about what's happening, and they have their conversation, and he walks away, and he maybe goes like another 50 yards and stops and turns around, and he just kind of yells back. He's like, hey, there is a version of you at the end of this trail that gets this record, and then just spun and turned and left again. And I was like, man, he's so right. And I see that person and I'm kind of intimidated by what he's going to have to go through. And I thought about that guy so many times over like the next 280 miles. I'm like, you know, lots of low points. And I'm like, you know, there is a version and he has to make a choice right now. Right. And the choice is to like keep trudging, dude. So, that was probably that's a moment that I'll carry from this one. It's just like the fat, happy Buddha walking through the woods going, hey man, you know, you got options. And there is a version of you that gets to the end and gets to the end as fast as you want to get there.
That's an amazing benediction to just get from some guy randomly in the middle of an FKT. Brent, how about you?
The one really memorable thing, once you get past the deadfall zone that is Sergeant's Mesa, and I think it's 114 you cross at Cochetopa Pass area, and there's a bunch of just dirt roads there. I got poured on really hard. It was totally demoralizing because it's not pretty at all. You're just on these dirt roads. There was trail magic of cold Waterloo seltzers. And I was like, that's the last thing I want. It's pouring down rain. I'm freezing. So I kept going through there and I made my way into the Lagaritas. And right around that time in the evening, the sun came out. So you had that like golden hour light and you go to, I think it's Cochetopa Creek. It's a beautiful like Oxbow Valley. And I was like, this is the prettiest place in Colorado. And I was going through all these aspen tunnels, dropping in there. And this guy's like, oh, if you go a little further, there's some moose. And I hadn't eaten in a while. So I just sat right across this beautiful creek. And on the other side was a calf and a cow moose just chomping away as I'm having my little freeze-dried meal. And it was beautiful. And then I get to Eddiesville Trailhead after dark. And there's some people setting up tents who are also through hikers. And I'm like, all right, fellas, just so you know, I'm going to be getting up at 3 a.m. and I'll try not to wake you up. And they're like, well, why don't you just go sleep in the pit toilet? And I was like, wow, I never thought about that. And I was really tired of getting rained on at that point. I was like, I could go a night without worrying about rain and having that anxiety. So I slept in this pit toilet and I probably slept about 7 hours straight. It was glorious. And at that moment, I was like, I'm going to get this thing done. I can actually do it now. So that was definitely the most memorable part for me because I was just about past halfway.
Jeff, how about you?
I have two quick ones. When I almost quit at Cottonwood, when I was having the kind of GI stuff and I was just really low after hiking that section of rain all night with Jesse. And that was the last section Jesse was pacing me. He came for the first few days, like 3-4 days. And he'd paced a bunch of shifts, a ton of shifts. He was just a superstar that first 4 days. And I mean, I think he paced almost 100 miles. And I just remember when I got out of the truck or out of the van from sleeping for like the longest sleep I had during the whole thing. And I had decided that I was going to continue. I go, let's get this. I said, you know what? Let's get this party started. And everyone started cheering. And Jesse's face and his reaction was just so amazing. Like he was so stoked. So that was a definitely like a highlight that I made the right decision. And then the other highlight for me during that whole thing. So every time we got through a transition zone and the pacer would get my little emergency kit burrito that they're carrying of really light, like waterproof pants and waterproof jacket, you know, emergency kit. And then a little gallon Ziploc of some gels and shoes. But there was always another like sandwich Ziploc in there that had some stuff for me that I carried on my person. Cause I carried a light kit, like a flask and phone and like some other like layers and just a couple of light layers. So anyway, every time the crew knew to pull the little small Ziploc out and hand it to me, my wife, when we were packing all those Ziplocs for all the transitions, she went back after we had them packed and she put a little like business card size piece of paper with either a quote, like an inspirational quote or a joke, like a dad joke, like out of a dad joke book that my 13-year-old has. So like a joke or a quote from a movie that we love or something. And so it became... that became like my Linus blanket from Peanuts. Like I needed that. Like every time I looked forward to the piece of paper, and there are a couple of times where the crew accidentally shuffled things around when we were messing around with new nutritional approaches and it got taken out somehow. And I would get going like quarter mile out of like the checkpoint and I'd be freaking out looking for the little piece of paper. Where's the piece of paper? Where's my wife's note? I'm freaking out. Like literally like emotional about it. And a couple times a crew came running up with like, here, man. And they're like, I know how important this is to you. And I was like, thanks, man. And I kept everyone. I kept it in a snack Ziploc. So I had a pile of them in a snack Ziploc. And I carried on me the whole time, every single quote. And, you know, that was like, I mean, it became like, every time I'd read them, I was like, there's a couple that teared me up. And they were just like stupid, cheesy quotes from like a movie, you know? But I'd be like, that's our like favorite movie. You know, like I'm like freaking out because you're so stripped down. Like, you know, by day 4 or 5, you're just like emotionally like all the onion layers are peeled away and you're just like this raw core. And so like I definitely was, you know, that was a big like lift every single time. Like I, you know, every checkpoint, I was like looking for that little piece of paper.
I think it was like the time I spent with my pacers. It was just like each section felt like such a unique chapter of what I was doing. My buddy Devin ran like 140 miles or so with me and he did a lot of the night sections too. And a lot of the really difficult sections. So I think of like our times together and like which sections really stick out of like how he suffered too, of carrying all my stuff along the way. And then like the sections I had with Robin, we got stormed on every time. She just like had such bad luck of getting hail. It seemed like Sarah seemed to get me for a lot of sunrise sunsets, which was really special to spend with my partner. Just got a lot of cool views of the Colorado Mountains. And then times like some real legends in the sport. I got Courtney to pace me for the second night. I got Jeff Browning, you know, to pace me for the last night. Just some really, really awesome experiences and some real professionals in the sport and people who took it seriously and really helped me accomplish my goals. I think that's what sticks out in my mind.
When you're doing an FKT, I mean, ultimately it's you and your internal journey, but that you got to share it with so many people in, like, you know, these memorable ways. That's really cool.